Have you been using Mint to manage your finances? First, you probably know the bad news. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There is a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. I have been using Monarch Money for over a year now, and it makes my weekly money dates so much easier and a lot less stressful. I tried all of the other personal finance apps, but they just didn't work for me. I love Monarch because I can see exactly where my money is going and track my goals all at the same time. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all of your accounts, your investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Monarch has a tool that also lets you easily import your data from Mint so you can keep all of your tags and categories. And unlike other personal finance apps, Monarch's simple, very intuitive design makes it so easy to set up, customize, and use. And one of the features I love most is Monarch has built-in features to collaborate with your partner, your family, or your financial advisor. You can invite them to your account at no extra cost. They get their own login, and you can have a joint view of your finances. Monarch is also the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up automatic rules for transactions. You can go to town with Monarch. Plus, they have ad-free privacy you can trust. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of the show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I was paying for vacations all wrong. I was missing out on miles. I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? I don't know, maybe that fancy hotel upgrade that you have always been dreaming about. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Past people might have told you 2 or 3 months salary. That's considered kind of old school knowledge and something that not sort of everybody abides by. But there are other people who find just tremendous comfort in having some sort of guideline like that. It really depends. And listen, there are some people who the ring is everything and they're okay with a more modest wedding. And vice versa, there are other people who are much less focused on the ring and maybe want to buy a house someday soon.
Hey, welcome back to Everyone's Talking Money. I am your host, Shauna Game, and love is in the air for this episode. Getting engaged can be a stressful time and a very expensive time. When do you propose? Who proposes to whom? How much money should you really spend on an engagement ring? What if you've never really talked about money before? These are just a few questions that our guest, Kat McCoy, a hopeless romantic, and the owner of Best Kept Jewelry Concierge and Proposal Prep, is here to help you with. I share this story in the episode, but when I got engaged to my husband, Jeff, we mutually bought the engagement ring. I picked it up myself. And then when I got home, I put it on the counter. And Jeff was like, okay, so what am I supposed to do with this thing? And I was like, I don't know. I guess you're supposed to propose. We laugh about it now, but the dynamics of the engagement process, even though it's exciting, can be stressful and anxiety-filled. So in this episode, Kat is breaking down the narrative around who should propose to whom, whether your engagement ring really is an investment, and some important love and money questions to ask your future spouse before you walk down the aisle. So before jumping in this episode, I would love to invite you to help Everyone's Talking Money reach more people. You can do so by subscribing or following the show, leaving a review if you haven't done so already, and sharing the show with your friends. Also, hey, if we aren't email friends yet, head to the link in the show notes to get on our email club list. Every Tuesday, I send out a short money tip and lots of other great behind-the-scenes things, money advice, and all sorts of things to help you stress less. You can find that link right in the show notes. All right, let's start talking about getting engaged. We're talking about getting engaged, and I know this is a really stressful time, I think, for both partners. No matter who's proposing and who's on the other side, right? There's a lot of like anxiety and nerves, and am I doing this right? And what if it's not what they want? Or what if they don't say yes, right? There's a lot of questions. And also, you know, who's going to buy the engagement ring? Who pays for the wedding? Like, there's a lot of money questions that are involved in this process. And I think, you know, it's awesome that you're out there helping navigate couples through these really important questions and helping them, you know, figure out how to deal with these really stressful situations. What would you say are like some of the trickiest questions that you think people need to talk about before they get into the proposal process?
Absolutely. I think the very first thing that comes to mind is this idea of timing. Typically, in an old school fashion, the person proposing would be in full control of the timeline of when you'll get engaged. But as modern relationships evolve, couples are typically living together before they get engaged as well. The question of on whose timeline are we on, I think, becomes a really important one.
All right, exactly. It's so interesting because, you know, I have a couple of friends who recently have got engaged, and it feels like there's always one partner who is just waiting and thinking, when is the other partner going to propose? Like, when is it going to happen? And they're just, you know, almost like so fixated on the timeline that, you know, everything else, like they can't think about anything else except like this timeline. It's so interesting.
You know, you're exactly right. There often can become a power imbalance between the two parties, and it's much bigger than just the proposal. For some people, it's, I want to have children. And that sort of pervasive biological clock, of course, can be a real thing. For other people, they'd like to book a specific wedding venue. And if you don't lock it in, maybe you're pushing until a 2025 wedding. So there's a lot of different components to that. And navigating that can be really challenging.
So how do you suggest couples navigate these awkward conversations? Like, what do you do if the tensions start to boil up around, you know, when we're going to get engaged? Like, specifically, I think if one partner has a timeline that's very different from the other partner.
I think being able to come to the table and feel like both people really have an equal seat at the table. The proposal prep box that I developed, there is a custom card game, essentially with some really fun icebreakers. So there's some kind of flirty questions to tee you up. And then there's some questions that get down to the nitty gritty. For instance, you know, true or false, it's important you speak to my family before you propose. True or false, 12 months is the perfect amount of time to be engaged. So it allows you to bring up topics that you might be bashful to bring up or ask each other questions that never even occurred to you.
I like that a lot. I often talk about, you know, question session when you're talking to your partner about money too, because if you come at it from this question and like very inquisitive perspective, it does take the tensions down. I think it also helps it feel less judgmental. So, you know, when somebody's answering that question, it could be like, oh, well, that's interesting. You think that's true or false? Like, why do you think that? You know, and I think there's a way to like bridge these conversations. Do you have any other, are there any other like hot questions in there that like couples just love?
From an engagement ring perspective, because I work in jewelry, it's a little bit engagement ring focused. One of the questions is, to what extent are you open to input on the engagement ring? How involved do you want to be? I think that's a really important question. The purpose of the box is to not by any means eliminate all mystery and romance. It's how to how to right size it for you guys as a couple. And so I love what you said about not being judgmental. It's so dependent on each couple. I work with some couples where both parties are deeply involved in the ring buying process. Everyone knows what everyone spent. And then I work with other couples who would be so embarrassed to know what their partner spent on a ring. So the box is not meant to be prescriptive. It's just sort of meant to help you figure out what's right for you guys.
And to be fun, right? To have
fun is the number one thing. I'm so happy you said that. And in terms of the game, the card game, making it a game instead of the original version, candidly, was a questionnaire. And when I spoke to particularly to the people who were meant to be proposing, when I said form or questionnaire, they completely shut down. And so I went back to the drawing board and I thought, how can we make this feel more like a game? So I think that's an excellent point.
I love that. You know, it's just like, I always remind people this process is supposed to be enjoyable. Like even, you know, when you think about like, I don't know, I'm stereotyping here, but like bridezillas or, you know, you get up to that wedding date and you're so stressed out and you're panicky or whatever it might be. It's I'm always reminding people like, this is supposed to be fun. Like this is supposed to be one of those good pieces of life that you really want to just enjoy and embrace it and not be so just like fixated, you know, on everything being right. And I think that we could pull that back to the engagement process too, right? Like there's such a narrative that the engagement has to be this like amazing spectacle and it has to be something of legends. And for a lot of people, that's not what they want, you know? And so I think thinking about it from that perspective is really important.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think what you're talking about is the proposal itself. The period of time that I've become just sort of obsessed with in recent years is what I call pre-engagement. That time from when you know you've met the right person to when you actually get engaged. And I think that's when a lot of those really like an emotionally rich power dynamics are coming up. To your point, a lot of stuff around money, a lot of stuff about power and whose timeline we're on and who gets a say. But the whole purpose of what I do is to really make the process of getting engaged and that period of pre-engagement more joyful and less stressful.
Wow, power dynamics. I hadn't even thought about it from that perspective, but that's very true. That's a head scratcher. So let's talk about the actual proposal process. You know, I think your expertise is in engagement rings and there's a lot of hinting that goes on, you know, what you want or what you don't want. And I think, you know, again, it's trying to figure out what to spend and what not to spend. You know, why do we put so much pressure on ourselves for ultimately like this piece of jewelry?
There's, of course, the tradition component. I think it's something that perhaps your mother wore. You've seen some of your friends get engaged. My kind of armchair theory is the rise of Instagram, I feel, is directly correlated to the importance of the engagement ring. I think we live in such a visual time and there is this expectation that the ring will be posted. And that's certainly not right for everyone, but across the board, I have found that engagement rings do feel kind of big and important. And I think part of that is because we do live in such a visual time.
Hmm. Instagram, I swear.
The gram. Right?
So much pressure. Well, it's interesting. I'll be married 10 years and we as a couple, this was our second marriage. And so we weren't putting so much pressure on who was going to buy the ring or the formalities that you normally follow in, you know, a first marriage, if you will. Like we had a pre-honeymoon where we went on vacation before we actually got married. And so we just kind of broke tradition all the way around. And I actually knew somebody in the jewelry business and, you know, we decided we'll put our resources together. And she actually had a like a vintage kind of secondhand ring that I really loved. And you know, so I was the one who actually went out and purchased the ring and I brought the ring home. And my husband always jokes about this because I put the ring on like the dining room table and I was like, okay, here's the ring. Like now do something about it. And he was like, wow, okay, well, like, no pressure there, you know? And I was merely saying like, okay, we have this ring now, you know, whenever we want to have the proposal, but I still laugh at myself now because I think, well, I could have been the one that proposed. Like, it didn't have to just be him, you know, and we both purchased the ring. So it wasn't like, you know, it's just so interesting, I think, to really dissect the process. And, you know, I always encourage couples, like, don't be afraid to like break the narrative or to change the story.
I think your example is such a perfect example of breaking the narrative because you felt empowered to go out and select a ring for yourself. And yet it sounds like there was some part of you that wanted to be proposed to, and there's nothing wrong with that either. And so I think there is absolutely a spectrum of traditional, non-traditional, and it's just so interesting and exciting to me when a couple really walks their own path.
I like that. Well, this is a money podcast, so let's talk about the money side of buying an engagement ring. You know, what should we know before we buy an engagement ring?
Perhaps which should be comforting, but maybe also a little frustrating, is from a budget perspective, there is such a tremendous range. I can tell you that the average engagement ring in the United States costs about $6,000. But you know, you can certainly buy one for far less, and you can buy one for a lot more as well. So doing your research and having a good understanding of budget based on what you're looking for, I think can be really important. On the engagement ring concierge side of my business, the one thing I can't do for you, or the one question I can't answer for you, is what's the right budget? It's incredibly personal. I think in the past, people might have told you 2 or 3 months' salary. That's considered kind of old school knowledge, and something that not sort of everybody abides by. But there are other people who find just tremendous comfort in having some sort of guideline like that. It really depends. And listen, there are some people who the ring is everything and they're okay with a more modest wedding. And vice versa, there are other people who are much less focused on the ring and maybe want to buy a house someday soon. So at the time that you're getting ready to get engaged, you might also be considering the cost of the wedding, buying a home together. There's a lot of kind of life events, juicy life events that kind of coincide with really sort of choosing your partner.
And I love that, because those are lots of things you don't think about. It's like somehow you just have a blank, like all you can see is, you know, the proposal and, you're not thinking about like all of the things that kind of come down the line or might be coming down the line. And it's really interesting. I love that you encourage couples to kind of think about those things. So in terms of the actual ring, there's all the four C's and all of those things that we've kind of heard over and over again. If we were to spend our money on one thing, like, are we looking for, you know, a good quality stone or diamond, or is it more important if the band is all gold or platinum, or, you know, are there any tips you can give us kind of in that direction?
Absolutely. So as you think about the four C's, it's really important to start with style and look-wise what you want and sort of back into what's important. I say that because, for instance, an emerald cut diamond, which has become very popular, clarity is going to be much more important for an emerald cut stone than it would be for a more brilliant cut stone like an oval or a round. So depending on the diamond shape, the different four C's matter more or less. And so being able to start from a place of, this is what I think is really beautiful and this is what I feel really comfortable in, can kind of help you determine where to prioritize. I work with some couples who it's really, really important to them that the color is an incredibly bright white. Other couples are looking for size, and so they're willing to go down in components like color and clarity to optimize for carat. So it's very personal, and it also depends on the shape of the diamond. From a setting perspective, I think you always want to be conscious of the craftsmanship and how the setting was made. 14 carat actually is a fantastic option. It's going to be a little bit more affordable than going with platinum. 14 karat gold.
Really? Why is that?
It has just the gold content and the mix of alloys and metals is different. Okay. 14 karat gold is stronger than platinum. So platinum will sort of patina with time, and it's a little bit of a softer metal, whereas 14 karat is a little bit stronger. So I think that's a fantastic way to save a few bucks and also sort of protect the setting. But there are some people who, platinum is just incredibly classic, and maybe that's what their mom wore and that's what they feel strongly about.
What about other gems? Are there any other like popular stones that people are buying besides diamonds these days?
Absolutely. Colored gemstones continue to be a really fantastic way to wear something a little bit more unique. So a blue sapphire, I think, is still really classic and timeless for an engagement ring, an emerald as well. The thing to understand about a green emerald is it's a bit of a softer stone than a diamond. And so if you're someone who works with his or her hands, if you, it's sort of a know thyself moment. If you, depending on what you do for work, an emerald might not be right for you just because it is more likely to chip.
Okay. And I've also seen like diamond alternatives. I can't think of the name right now. Is it, does it start with an M?
Moissanite.
Okay. Yes. Tell me about those.
Yes. So those have become quite popular as well. Without a doubt, a moissanite is going to be much more affordable than a natural mined diamond. What's become very, very popular, even just in the last couple of years, has been lab-grown diamonds. It's a really, really interesting conversation to have because a lab-grown diamond has the exact same chemical composition as a diamond that's mined from the earth. It's made using high pressure and high temperatures, but instead of high pressure and high temperatures in the ground, there's high pressure, high temperatures in the laboratory. And so you need a special piece of testing equipment to be able to tell the difference. The main difference between a mined diamond and a lab-grown diamond is resale value. Lots of laboratories have opened in recent years, and so the price of lab-growns continues to just sort of plummet. And so if this is something that, you know, you're going to have forever, pass it down the family, you don't care about sort of thinking of it as an asset, then with a lab-grown, your money and your budget is certainly going to stretch further.
Do people really, like, do they resell their engagement rings? Does that happen a lot?
It depends. I think some people think towards, do I want to upgrade in the future? I think other people really do think of it as an asset in their portfolio, and they want to know that they're making a smart investment that's going to maintain its value over time, regardless of whether or not they plan on selling.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. I'm interested about that because you talk about the ring as an investment. How do we think of the ring as investment, or how does it become an investment for us?
So as we think about sort of the natural diamond market, prices have remained and the market has remained pretty strong and has remained pretty consistent. And so, you know, that is very promising. Different trends and styles and shapes come in and out of favor. So antique cut diamonds for a while were seen as less expensive than more of the modern brilliant cuts. Antique cuts have sort of become back in favor. And so the price of those have continued to rise. You know, oval cut diamonds are incredibly popular. They were less so, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago. So if you were early on ovals, that was an incredible investment. For most people, with something as sentimental and romantic and as special as an engagement ring, that's not the only lens by which they're assessing their purchase. But, you know, this is a money podcast and you want to make a smart investment.
Life does not happen biweekly, so why should your payday? The money you earn can be in your hands today with Earnin. Earnin, it's an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you can access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. Listen, the money you get from Earnin, it could do a lot of things. Maybe you spend it on a gift for someone special in your life, or in my case, an unexpected and very expensive trip to the vet for my pup Winnie. Or maybe you use the money towards your upcoming rent payment. There are lots of ways the Earnin money could go to use. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability, security. It gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Talkin, T-A-L-K-I-N, money, under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. Talkin, money, under podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
All right, Kat, we're going to play your relationship with money is game. First question, if you were to describe your relationship with money as a cartoon character, who would it be?
I've heard this on other episodes of yours, and every time I'm like, I have no idea what I would say. I think Bugs Bunny, because there are times when you probably should more deeply assess, but I just want to keep moving forward.
That's great. Question number two, when you think about money, are your thoughts mostly positive or negative?
My thoughts are mostly positive. I've been doing a lot of mindset work this year, trying to be in that abundance mindset. And I know it sounds a little woo-woo, but it's so powerful. And I just find I can feel happier and sort of experience money with a little more lightness in that way.
If you were granted one money wish, it could be anything. What would your wish be?
My one money wish would be every time I go to lunch or dinner with a friend, the check gets paid for. That to me is the ultimate. Is being able to treat a friend to lunch or dinner is just the ultimate indulgence. And if some sort of wizard, just every time you went to lunch with a friend, paid for it, that would be my wish.
I like that one. I could get on board with that. All right, last question. What is one money secret you have that maybe you don't talk about often?
Yes. So I would say one money secret of mine was my very first year in business. I have been really fortunate. I've only worked with really honest partners. I got taken by a fraudster on a Rolex watch, and I felt so much shame about being tricked. And it ended up, you know, it was a big kick in the gut. It cost me several thousand dollars. It's a lesson I vowed I would only learn once, but it was a really shameful experience not to only lose that money, but to feel like I wanted to make the sale so badly that I didn't take all of the necessary precautions.
Want to know the number one money question I'm asked? It's how to get started investing without being overwhelmed. So if you're asking yourself the same question, then you have to check out the Investing for Beginners podcast. The hosts, Dave and Andrew, they break down investment terms and strategies in a way you can finally understand. I love that they're making investing accessible, and they have an entire podcast dedicated to helping you invest better. Even if you're not ready to start investing, they explain the stock market and financial updates so you can really understand what is being said on the news. If you're ready to learn more about investing, I'd recommend you start with two of my favorite episodes. Listener Q&A, how do you start investing with $1,000, where they explain how you get started right away. And Back to Basics of Building Your Portfolio, where they explain how to build a portfolio from scratch. The Investing for Beginners podcast is a great way to start expanding your relationship with money. Find Investing for Beginners podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Rena Ninen, the host of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Over the past few years, we've looked at how women around the world are changing societal norms to increase their economic power. This season, we're focusing completely on girls, how they're pushing for a brighter, more powerful future, and what the rest of us can do to set them up for success. Join us for stories about girl power, young women who are fighting for change, to give themselves a chance to live a life of their own choosing. That's season 6 of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Karina Bemisdurfer, host of Morning Cup of Murder, your daily true crime podcast. Yes, you heard me right, daily true crime. Every day, Morning Cup of Murder tells you a straightforward, short-form story about murder, true crime, cold cases, disappearances, serial killers, cults, and more. And I do that all in under 15 minutes. With over 3 years of stories and over 20 million downloads, the Morning Cup of Murder podcast has become a staple of so many people's daily routines. So why not add it to yours? Stream Morning Cup of Murder everywhere you listen to podcasts. And remember, stay safe.
I'm also thinking, you know, outside of like same-sex couples, I'm wondering, are you seeing more women propose to men? Like, are you seeing an uptick in that trend at all?
Anecdotally, not as much, but I read about it quite a bit. And listen, I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, we keep talking about relationship dynamics.
So am I. You know, a lot of my
girlfriends are between you and me. I'm a little surprised that and, we haven't seen.
You know, no judgment, good way, but very particular about what they want and how they want the proposal process to go, and the ring they want, and you know, all of that. And so, like we were saying before, like so fixated on making sure that, you know, their fiance, future fiance, knows like exactly what they want, but then also like terrorized that they're not going to do certain things. And I've often said, like, well, why don't you be the one that proposes? Like, if you have an exact idea of what you want, like, there's nothing wrong with the woman or proposing. And I think it's so interesting that we still sometimes get hung up on those, you know, sort of gender stereotypes, if you will, that it absolutely has to be the man proposing. And there's nothing wrong with any which way you do this. I would just, you know, encourage anyone listening, like if you're feeling that way, like I say, go for it. I think it's a really interesting story to have.
I hear you. The proposal prep box that we've developed, I think, also offers you, if you are quite particular, which a lot of people are, it allows you an opportunity to really tell your partner what you want and to make it a little bit more collaborative as well. I love to recommend, if you're open to it, that couples go to a local jewelry store and try on options together. The best thing you can do is see different things on your hand. You can see, think something's really beautiful, but on your own hand, it just sits a little bit differently. Of course, the shape of your fingers. And so it's a really nice way to be able to say, hey, I really like that second ring. What did you think about it? It becomes a little bit more collaborative that way. And as we think about, you know, that pre-engagement journey, there's different parts in the journey where you can kind of exit the process. So a common route that a lot of my clients take is they will go to a jewelry store together, try on a few options. She might say, I really liked A, B, and C, did not like D, E, and F. This is my input, run forth and prosper. And it's sort of a nice way of doing it because there's still a little bit of that mystery of romance. If the person buying the ring is interested in expressing themselves a little bit, there's a little bit of room to make a final call or decide between the few options they teed up. But there are different sort of exits you can, different ramps you can exit throughout the process depending on your appetite for that.
I like that. Yeah, because I was wondering, you know, do you suggest like couples go through the actual buying process together? But I like that they're are different off ramps that you can get off, you know, depending. And also you can be okay that you go through, like my husband and I, we went through the whole process together. We both knew exactly what we were purchasing. And, you know, there wasn't necessarily a surprise element, but that part wasn't important to me. I know that, you know, is also important to a lot of other people. You mentioned some, you know, ways that we could kind of save money if the budget's really tight, but I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions or ideas if, you know, we don't have, I think you said the average is like $6,000. So if that isn't something that is accessible to us, are there any other ways that we can kind of cut down on some of the costs, but still have something special?
Absolutely. So a vintage ring, of course, there's a range for vintage as well, but that's definitely a path to explore. And is, of course, of all the options, the most sustainable. So I think that's become important to a lot of my clients as well. So the number one best sustainable way is to buy a ring that has been pre-loved. So I think that's absolutely something to consider. A colored gemstone is going to, you know, most of the time be more affordable than a traditional white diamond. As I mentioned, a lab-grown diamond is also going to be more affordable than a natural mined diamond. Moissanite, a diamond alternative, which you named, is another great option. There are just a lot of different options.
Right. So don't be sad or dismayed if you don't have a big budget. There are lots of ways to still get a gorgeous ring. And I think the beauty is that a lot of times we can feel, you know, I talk a lot about shame around money because there's a lots of ways we feel shameful. And so I think sometimes you could feel shameful if you're not spending a certain amount on the ring, or you know you're buying something that is, you know, an alternative that isn't an actual diamond. But the beauty of it is nobody else has to know that information. And nobody else probably would, you know, and but people don't walk around asking how much money did you spend on your engagement ring? Like, that isn't a socially acceptable thing. So I think, you know, it's great if you can find a way. I mean, I talk about relationship with money all the time, and that's a great way to work on your relationship with money, to find something that's in your budget that you both like, and let go of all the stigma and the shame around it being, you know, a certain thing or having to be a certain amount of money that you spend on the ring.
Absolutely. As we've both said, there's so many different ways to do it. And I think as long as you're both communicating together, then that's a really, you know, powerful place to start.
So you've been able to craft this career around, you know, helping other people, you know, get engaged, go through this, you know, pre-proposal process. And as you say, you like to do it with as little stress and as humanely as possible. I love that combination. What sparked your interest in getting involved in this work?
So I started my fine jewelry concierge about 6 years ago. And prior to that, I was a management consultant. So I did not come through the traditional jewelry path. In fact, I work with a lot of talented people in the Diamond District in New York City, and the majority of people you work with are going to be third or fourth generation, so they think you're absolutely nuts to be entering the industry. But I've always loved jewelry. The business before I got so focused on engagement rings was really focused on sourcing really special gifts, because I believe a piece of jewelry is one of the most meaningful gifts you could give someone. But if you get it wrong, it can be so crushing for both the person receiving and the person giving. And so I wanted to offer a way for people to feel like they couldn't get it wrong. And my love of jewelry really comes from my grandmother, who was far and away the most thoughtful gift giver, an incredibly elegant woman who loved things that were really well made. And every kind of gift she gave you felt like a reflection of of the very best that she saw in you. So my love language is very much gift giving. And I wanted to sort of infuse that spirit in jewelry, because I think sometimes fine jewelry has a rap of being shallow or unimportant. But when done thoughtfully, I think it can just be so special.
I love that story of your grandma. I think about my grandma's, and I didn't, my dad's mom passed away when I was very little, I think 2 and a half, maybe 3. So I really don't have any memory of her, but she loved collecting jewelry, and just all types of jewelry, everything from, you know, fancy jewelry down to just, you know, kind of tchotchke jewelry. And when she passed away, she left her jewelry collection to my aunt, which her daughter. And then when my aunt passed away, she left the jewelry collection to my mom and myself. And it was really cool to be able to kind of, I don't know, like feel her through the jewelry, or to like see her personality kind of come through, because I didn't really, you know her that well through jewelry. And I think that's what you're saying. Like, that's why you love what you do, because it's not just something you know, slap on your finger or, you know, you wear around your neck. These gifts can actually have like this real sort of meaning behind it. And it's like you could feel the person that has, you know, gifted you this particular item.
Yes, to think that her collection she enjoyed and then has been passed down now several times is so powerful. And I find people's taste in jewelry so interesting, because your taste in jewelry is not necessarily doesn't have a one-to-one correlation with your taste in fashion. It's informed by like a lot of other things. And so to really go through someone's jewelry box is a very intimate thing, and a very personal thing. And it's so cool to think, that, you know, her collection has been passed down in that way.
So I've got to ask, because we're talking about proposals, did you have a unique proposal story or anything, you know, that interesting? Did you get what you want?
Yeah. So I got engaged, I guess, 8 years ago at this point, and I entered the jewelry business about 18 months later. So wow. I had no idea what was going on through that process. My husband Clay and I, we went into the Diamond District. This is before I had all of these partners on 47th Street. We were both so nervous because if you've ever been to the Diamond District in Manhattan, it moves quickly. A lot of people are yelling at you. Are you buying? Are you selling? What are you looking for? I remember actually being so nervous that I dropped a loose diamond on the ground, which I, as a jeweler myself now, I'm just horrified thinking about. But in the spirit of honesty, I do love that story. And we tried on a few different things. I pointed, gave him a few hints and told him what I really, really didn't want. And then told him to go off and do his best. And so, my ring is so special to me. And, my husband Clay, he has more of a traditional finance job. And for him, it was really an opportunity to, kind of be creative and design something really special. So, he actually took a lot of pleasure in the sort of design process. Whereas other people find it very stressful. So, to each their own, but my ring is so special to me, and it just reminds me of
process. You went to the jewelry district there, you were overwhelmed, and then you told him, like, okay, now it's your turn, like, you go back, you figure it all out.
Yes, here are the keys.
I'm sure when you got in the jewelry business later, he was like, oh my gosh, like, this information would have been very helpful in the process.
Exactly. It was kind of shortly thereafter that that I dove headfirst into the jewelry space, building relationships in the Diamond District. So I think about that often. Kind of my first trip there was for my own engagement ring sort of scouting. And there are a million things I would have done differently, but I kind of love that that was our story.
Is that something you would suggest for people? You know, I used to live in Los Angeles and they had a huge Diamond District, a lot like New York. Do you suggest people to like go down there? I mean, can they get a better deal, or is that just like such an overwhelming process?
I think you have to ask yourself what the goal of the day is. For your first time out, I would much rather see you go to a local jewelry store. It's going to be a little friendlier, a little bit slower paced. They might take a little bit more pleasure in explaining what it is you're looking at and educating you a little bit. The Diamond District is absolutely fantastic, and there's some really talented, really honest people there, but it is best to go to the Diamond District if you know what you want, you know what you're willing to spend, and you're sort of ready to transact.
All right. So you've got this amazing proposal prep box. And I'm wondering, you know, as we close out here, if you were to put together just a couple of things that you want us to think about, like the ultimate proposal prep kind of checklist for us, what would be on it? What are the things we absolutely have to remember in this process?
I guess the first thing would be setting aside just an hour one evening and talking through any of your anxieties, what's on both of your minds, in an ideal world, what both of your timelines would be, and kind of setting the table together, I think would be my very first step. It's not for everybody, but if you're open to it, my best piece of advice in terms of truly figuring out what type of engagement ring you want, the best thing you can do is go to a jewelry store and see things on your own hand. When I think about my clients on the concierge side, 9 times out of 10, after going to a store to try things on, people change their minds even just a little bit, whether it be the side stones, the way the prongs are set. Even if you have a very strong idea of what you want, there's no substitute for seeing something on your hand. So that would probably be the second major step. The third major step, you know, thinking so much about our conversation today would be to remind yourself to really enjoy it. This is supposed to be a joyful time. And you can kind of pave your own way. So do not at all forget to kind of stop and smell the roses. And the last thing I would do is think really long and hard about the jeweler that you want to work with, because a reputable jeweler will coach you through the entire process. They'll provide you incredible counsel. and really feel like a partner in the process for you. I think oftentimes people can be a little hesitant to share what their true budget is with their jeweler. So they'll hedge and say it's several thousand dollars less. But if you trust the person that you're working with, the best thing you can do is be honest, because I know some people who maybe at the top of your budget is X dollars, but they might show you something just over that, but they're willing to take a little bit of a haircut because they really like you. So if you trust your jeweler and can really think of them as a partner, the process becomes, you know, so different.
This was a fun episode for me. I think, like Kat, I'm a little bit of a hopeless romantic myself. And I just love all the information that she shared. I think especially these questions about what to ask your future spouse are so important. And I often suggest that when people are coming to me for a money session and they're getting ready to get engaged or to get married, to be able to ask your partner some vulnerable questions about this whole process, about what's important to them, about money stuff, about life stuff. All of this goes a long way. And I think it's just another form of intimacy that you can have in your relationship. And we don't ask the questions because sometimes I think we don't want to know the answers, or we're afraid what the answers are. Like, if my future spouse tells me that they want a different vision of life, or they don't want to spend money on something that I want to spend money on, then that automatically creates a place of conflict, and that feels scary. But it's more important to ask these questions and to have the knowledge and to remember to try to keep a safe space and a place where you and your partner feel like they can share all sorts of things, even about these dynamics around engagement. Do we have to do the rules of engagement? Can we make this our own? What do we want? Like, let go of those kind of Disney fairy tale illusions around engagement in this whole process and money and all of it, and find something that truly works for the both of you. If you want to find out more about Kat, you can go to proposalprep.com. I will link that in the show notes, as well as Best Kept Jewelry Concierge. I'll have all that in the show notes. You can pop over and connect with her and ask any additional questions that you're just dying to know. If you enjoyed this episode, again, make sure you're on our email club list. You can go to etmpod.link/email club. And please do me a favor, share this episode, head on over, leave a review, and give our sponsors some love as well. I'll see you back here in a few days for a brand new episode.